Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Arshad Hassan of the group Democracy for America, who explains why he and other progressive activists strongly oppose President Obama's deal with the GOP on extending Bush-era tax cuts to the nation's wealthiest citizens. Terry St. Pay of the Barataria-Terrebonne National Estuary Program, who talked about the British Petroleum Gulf oil spill's continuing impact on the environment. And Danny Schechter, executive editor at MediaChannel.org, who examines the U.S. corporate media's spin on the WikiLeaks release of U.S. government documents and the public's right to know about their government's conduct. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Powerful unions in South Africa, like the Congress of South African Trade Unions, have joined a new campaign to oppose Walmart's plan to buy out South African big box retailer, Massmart. South African unions with close links to the ruling African National Congress government are seeking to block Walmart from its plan to rapidly expand in sub-Saharan Africa. To disrupt ongoing merger talks, the South African Commercial, Catering and Allied Workers Union launched a broad-based campaign against Walmart and its anti-union practices. South African unions are also calling for Walmart to release its handbook that advises managers how to preserve a union-free workplace. According to the news magazine In These Times, the union is demanding that Walmart accept the existing terms and conditions of current labor contracts with Massmart. The South African campaign is based on the success of the U.S. Wake Up Walmart campaign, organized by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, that blocked Walmart in major cities like Los Angeles. As the financial crisis worsened in the fall of 2008, General Electric borrowed $16 billion by selling commercial paper through the Federal Reserve System. GE relied on these short-term loans to pay for daily operating expenses. After Lehman Brothers declared bankruptcy on September 15, 2008, the market for commercial paper dried up, and the Fed intervened to keep the commercial paper marketplace open. Through a congressional mandate, the Fed recently disclosed that 82 companies borrowed $738 billion through the Federal Reserve's commercial paper funding facility. According to the investigative website ProPublica, GE had $100 billion in outstanding debt in commercial paper in 2008. Though claiming publicly there were no financial problems, GE CEO Jeffrey Immelt met privately with President Bush's Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and laid out a very different scenario, according to Paulson's new book about the crisis. If Paulson's new book, On the Brink, Inside the Race to Stop the Collapse of the Global Financial System, is correct, it could mean trouble for GE in court. Shareholders are accusing Immelt and other company officials in civil suits for withholding key information and misleading investors. Former Alaska governor and possible Republican presidential candidate Sarah Palin has paid thousands of dollars for a mysterious research consultant whose office consists of a mailbox in Wyoming. According to Mother Jones magazine, the researcher is right-wing Dutch blogger Joshua Levestro, who has long defended Palin, the former GOP vice presidential candidate, for media critics ranging from The Atlantic magazine, Politico, and the conservative National Review. Levestro is founder of the right-wing Edmund Burke Foundation in the Netherlands, created to counter mainstream social democratic ideals in the Western European country. During the height of the Bush War in Iraq, Levestro compared the abuse of Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib in Baghdad to an out-of-control frat party. In the 1990s, Levestro worked for Britain's Conservative Party as an aide to Fritz Bolkestein, then a member of the European Commission dealing with financial services issues. According to a report by the website Real Clear Politics, Levestro was paid $16,000 by Palin's Sarah PAC to advise the Tea Party's favorite Republican on the European debt crisis. In recent weeks, Palin has blasted the Federal Reserve for orchestrating a new round of stimulus by purchasing over $600 billion in U.S. Treasury bonds. Former George W. Bush speechwriter David Frum has criticized Palin's choice of advisors. In mid-November, Frum wrote on his blog, "It's almost as if Governor Palin finds the idea of expertise not merely incomprehensible, but actually repugnant." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In the aftermath of the Democrats' loss of the House in November's midterm congressional election, one of the biggest issues facing legislators in the lame duck session, which ends at the end of the year, was what to do with the expiring Bush-era tax cuts. Unemployment insurance is about to expire for millions of out-of-work Americans, but the Republican strategy was to hold extending support for the unemployed and continuing middle-class tax cuts hostage in return for getting President Obama to renege on his campaign pledge to end the Bush tax cuts for the nation's wealthiest citizens. The GOP gambit worked, as Mr. Obama announced a deal with congressional Republicans on December 6th that extended tax cuts to the middle class, as well as for the top 2% income earners, for another 2 years. In return, the president received Republican support for a 13-month extension of jobless benefits, a 2% employee payroll tax cut, and the continuation of other tax credits included in the president's stimulus legislation. The president's supporters maintained that this was the best deal that the White House could get without the votes needed to overcome a GOP filibuster. But progressive activists and some congressional Democrats voiced strong opposition to the deal, citing polls that suggested a majority of the country would have backed the president if he chose to stand and fight. There is also resistance to a part of the agreement that would set the estate tax top rate at 35% for estates over $5 million, the lowest since 1931. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Arshad Hassan, executive director of the group Democracy for America, founded by former presidential candidate Howard Dean in 2004. Hassan explains why his group vehemently opposes the Obama GOP tax deal and the campaign now being organized to derail the White House concessions that many progressives view as the ultimate political surrender.
Americans don't want a tax cut for the richest 2%. They do want, you know, unemployment benefits to be extended. We're basically trading something that nobody wants for something that people don't want. I mean, this is really, we're not even just giving away the farm. We're giving it away and getting crap in return for it. So we should be passing unemployment benefits extension because that's what Americans want. We should not be passing the tax cut because that's not what Americans want. Instead, Obama's making a deal with the Republicans to do exactly the opposite.
When this is discussed, it's often put in the context of, if Obama doesn't cave in, the Republicans will hold everyone's middle-class tax cuts hostage. Thereby, this blackmail will result in people blaming the White House and Obama for not permitting a deal like is being discussed now to go through. Politically speaking, people surrounding the president and the president himself perceive this as a deal they have to make or they will suffer political consequences. How do you respond to that idea?
Well, that doesn't make any sense, and I've seen that interpretation played about in some of the news and some of the newspapers and online as I've been reading. But here's the thing: if Republicans were really serious about a tax cut, they would have voted for the tax cut that was offered to them in the House. They were even given a choice in the House of Representatives. Democrats did pass a tax cut or an extension of these tax cuts. It just excluded the top $250,000 of income, which really only 2% of Americans make anyway. Republicans voted against that in favor of, you know, this sort of gambit that they're playing, that they want to make the Democrats look bad. But the fact of the matter is that they had the opportunity to vote for a middle-class tax cut. They refused it, and instead they're playing this game. So it really doesn't make sense because it is a fact that they had a chance to vote for this tax cut. It is a fact that Democrats did pass a middle-class tax cut. It wasn't good enough for them, so they're sort of holding it hostage. Really, if President Obama wanted to be a leader on this, he could start talking about the tax cut that Democrats did pass, that Republicans did obstruct. Instead, he's playing into the hands of the Republicans, honestly making it more difficult for other Democrats to really have a clear message on middle class priorities.
Now, one of the elements of the Republicans' argument for supporting tax cuts for the 2% wealthiest citizens is that they say that any reinstatement of the tax before the Bush tax cuts would hinder job creation. And, of course, this hinges on the whole trickle-down philosophy that gives the rich enough money and they'll invest it in creating businesses and thereby jobs. And certainly a lot of people are convinced by that argument because they're looking for something that will tamp down this nearly 10% unemployment rate.
Well, that trickle-down economics theory hasn't really been proven right in the last three decades, certainly not this, in this last decade. Remember that in the 90s, we had these slightly higher taxes that we would default to if there's no tax cut passed. But in the 90s, we had a great deal of economic prosperity, not true in these last few years when we've had these tax cuts. And here's one of the reasons why. Wealthy people, very wealthy people, I'm not talking about, you know, your successful neighbor down the street, but very wealthy people, when they have extra money, they don't necessarily spend it all. If you take a look at exactly the opposite, which are unemployment benefits for people who are looking for jobs, they don't have, you know, obviously they don't have a job, so they don't have a great deal of money. So then the money they do get, they need to spend on necessities, food, clothing, and so on. So that money will be spent. That money will go into the economy. Very wealthy people, when they get another 2% that they don't get taxed, there's no guarantee that they're spending that 2% on things which enrich the whole economy as a large. So the entire theory of trickle-down economics doesn't really work in practice.
What's the game plan now for progressive activist groups like yours? Explain to us what people are mobilizing to do now in the face of this this negotiation over the Bush tax cuts.
So here's what's happening next. One thing that your listeners can definitely do is to call your senators. I think it's a good idea to call your senators, regardless if they're Democrat or Republican. Now, you're not going to get as far with the Republicans, but it's important to get those voices out there. Remember, Tea Partiers didn't just talk to Republicans. They made a lot of noise for Republicans and Democrats. So it's important to call the senator. That's one thing that all of us can do. Whatever deal, you know, Barack Obama cuts with some of these Democratic leaders, mostly in the Senate, that's just one step. That's not the legislation itself. So the Senate then passes this, you know, this deal. So they have to get through that. Now, Bernie Sanders or any Democratic senator could decide to filibuster, which would be kind of a peculiar case right there. So if Bernie Sanders decides to filibuster, then he's putting himself against not just Barack Obama, but also a number of people in the Senate Democratic leadership. He's going to need to be able to get 40 Democrats to vote with him against the Republicans and against what looks like to be some of the Democratic Party leadership. Now, we actually have another chance even after that. So let's say that this deal passes the Senate, that our filibuster is unsuccessful. The problem with that is all tax and revenue bills have to originate in the House because this bill would be different than the one the House passed. The House would have to repass the compromise bill. That means you have to go through Nancy Pelosi and go through the House progressives who've been far more united on this issue, and they're the ones who've already passed the middle-class tax cut that excludes income over $250,000. So really, there's a number of steps here, and I think we'll have a couple more opportunities to really stop this, but I'd rather see this stopped in the Senate because they're not actually going to let it go, let it pass the Senate without already having cut some deals in the House. If we can stop it here, this is our best chance. If it passes both the House and Senate, obviously Barack Obama will sign it, and we'll have a lot more difficult time campaigning in the next 2 years.
That was Arshad Hassan, Executive Director of Democracy for America. Contact the group by calling area code 802-651-3200 or visit their website at democracyforamerica.com. In late summer, NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, issued a report claiming that three-quarters of the more than 5 million barrels of oil that erupted from British Petroleum's Deepwater Horizon's oil rig after the platform's explosion, which killed 11 workers, had disappeared. Many biologists and scientists studying the Gulf oil spill were very skeptical of that finding, but a more recent government report from November more or less confirms that study. Still, the long-term impact of the massive BP oil spill on the environment and the fishing industry won't be known for many years. The use of toxic chemical dispersants to break up the massive oil slicks and the building of sand berms or artificial barrier islands to defend against the movement of oil into estuaries rich with sea life continue to be controversial 5 months after the flow of oil into the Gulf was stopped. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Kerry St. Pay, the executive director of the Barataria-Tarbon National Estuary Program in the Bayou Country west of New Orleans that was most heavily affected by the BP disaster. He talks about the oil spill's short and long-term impacts, as well as effective and ineffective measures used to mitigate the damage.
There was heavy impact in the Barataria and Tarbon Bay, but it wasn't even comparable to the impacts that I've received in a 1997 spill of 10,000 barrels that occurred deep in the estuary. There's no way that 10,000 barrels were felt in the Barataria-Tarbone Basin from this spill, although there was a lot more oil released than 10,000 barrels. Nevertheless, the Barataria Basin particularly was heavily impacted, particularly in the Bird area. To the naked eye, things look pretty good. The oil came in and affected some of the vegetation, and it killed marine organisms, especially the post larva and larval shrimp and fishes. The oil impacted a lot of vegetation. The vegetation has recovered. The places that were killed above the sediment, the grass has respotted. And I would say that 90 to 95% recovered. But the offshore breeding stocks, offshore fisheries, that we don't know how much that was affected. The long-term effects, we won't know for several years. We have to monitor so that we can find out what the impacts are to the offshore breeding stocks. We have to monitor long enough so that we can tell that what we've seen as far as impacts, changes in the population, are due to the oil rather than due to the normal fluctuations in the population.
Kerry St. Pei, at least 1.8 million gallons of the chemical dispersant Corexit were sprayed both on the surface and deep underwater in the Gulf to try to break up the oil. What's your view on their use?
Dispersants don't lessen the impact, the toxicity of the oil at all. The only thing they can do is transfer the area where you affect, where you see impacts. And with the southeast winds we have in Louisiana predominantly, there's no question that most of that oil, if not all of it, would have been stacked up in our internal estuary, blown by the southeast wind. And, you know, downwind is the Barataria-Tarbone National Estuary, as well as the Breton Sound Estuary. So by dispersing it, by allowing that oil, dispersed oil, to be mixed with the water column, you have a situation where the oil is now moving in accordance with the currents, which takes it away from Louisiana. So those impacts are felt in the open Gulf, which is a lesser impact as far as, you know, vulnerability of the organism.
So, on balance then, did you support the use of dispersants the way they were used?
Yes, I did. In my opinion, it was the best thing to do.
Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal initiated a project, which I guess is still going on, to build sand berms along the shoreline, ostensibly to protect the estuaries from the oil, but a lot of experts said it wasn't going to be effective. What do you think?
We didn't support the building of the sand berms at all. We didn't formally object to the construction of the sand berm, although we did voice opposition in the media. That was going to be at a cost of $180 million, and BP was paying for it. And aside from the enormous waste of resource, waste of sand that we could have used to construct the Barrier Islands legitimately, they built these sand berms, which were six-foot-high levees of sand for the purpose of, quote, keeping the oil out, and we saw that as a not a good thing.
That was Kerry St. Pei, Executive Director of the Barataria-Tarbone National Estuary Program in Thibodaux, Louisiana. Contact the group at 1-800-259-0869 or visit their website at btnep.org. With his unauthorized release of thousands of classified military files related to the U.S. war in Afghanistan this summer, Australian citizen Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, became an internationally known public figure virtually overnight. Over the past few weeks, WikiLeaks has released thousands of secret U.S. State Department cables exposing Washington's confidential discussions of international issues and assessments of heads of state. with less than 1% of the estimated 250,000 cables published on the Internet or in the pages of five newspapers that were given the entire archive, there is the potential for future dramatic revelations. But as U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder explored ways to prosecute Mr. Assange, and some American politicians and commentators called for the WikiLeaks founder to be assassinated or designated as a terrorist, British police arrested Assange December 7th on a Swedish extradition warrant related to alleged sex offenses. In anticipation of government efforts to silence him, Assange, who was denied bail by a London court, had earlier threatened to automatically release key U.S. State Department cables if he or his group were subject to legal action. He has ensured the documents would be accessible as needed by sending over 100,000 people around the world the entire archive of 250,000 cables in encrypted form. The pressure on Assange had been building in the days before his arrest, since the web hosting division of Amazon.com, PayPal.com, and a Swiss bank severed their business relationships with WikiLeaks. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Danny Schechter, editor at MediaChannel.org, who examines the U.S. corporate media's spin on the WikiLeaks story and the public's right to know about their government's conduct versus the determination of those in power to keep sensitive diplomatic and military information secret.
Well, you know, first of all, let's look at this. 250,000 diplomatic cables is really at issue here. This is not an analysis of these cables, but simply the raw data that's being provided to newspapers and other media outlets in hopes that they'll add some context and background to it. And of these documents, 250,000 so far, only something like 700 is on the website of WikiLeaks, okay? So, you know, you're in a situation here where we don't really have all of these documents yet, but we do see a pattern here, and this is really what's important. The pattern is that overseas in Germany and in England and Spain, and you know, the focus is really looking at American foreign policy and how it is conducted. And so the documents that they've been focusing on really help illuminate American foreign policy practices, how it operates, how the diplomats work, whether, you know, as in being encouraged to spy at the United Nations, or really documents that deal with the wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan, as well as individual countries. What the American media has focused on, of course, is the personality stuff, you know, the nurse that accompanies Muammar Gaddafi around, the Ukrainian voluptuous nurse, you know, she's probably gotten more ink than almost anything else here. And, of course, the narrative that the American media, New York Times particularly, has seized upon is really consistent with the government approach, basically looking at Iran as bad guys in the world, and documents that show that other countries see Iran in that light, particularly Arab states that have been lobbying the United States to go to war against, you know, Iran, including, you know, Israel. And so the U.S. media has been sort of burying any facts that counter the case for war. So again, the same pattern that I saw in of U.S. media putting forth a pro-war narrative, it seems to be doing the same here. Except, in this particular case, you have a global audience for all of this. And, you know, in various countries, the governments are upset about it. Karzai in Afghanistan is blaming the United States for it. And the U.S. government has tried to, you know, crush WikiLeaks. There have been denial of service attacks on its website. But according to figures I've seen, there are 507 websites in the world that are actually mirroring the WikiLeaks. So the United States government has been unable to bury it, which is also significant because we're now in an age of info war with governments now involved in hacking and trying to stop information that they don't like. And WikiLeaks has really brought this contradiction out.
Do you get the feeling that the elite U.S. corporate media feel the public has a right to know here, or are they siding with the Pentagon and the White House that this stuff should be suppressed?
Well, they're doing both at the same time. That's what's so interesting here. They're you know, saying, well, we're you know, printing these documents because we think they're important and we think the public has a right to know. But we're also spinning these documents in a way that tends to support the very values that WikiLeaks is challenging by its act of releasing these documents. So the papers really line up with the status quo and with the establishment. You know, there was this flap with the New York Times where, you know, when the last disclosures came out on a Sunday, they carried the disclosures and they carried a really snarky profile of Assange, you know, as a troubled person, you know, quoting people who used to work with him and all this. That's why Assange didn't want to give the documents to the New York Times this time. But the Guardian, of all things, gave it to the New York Times. And the reason was that they were afraid the British government would try to suppress the publication in England. So by giving it to the New York Times, they made it more widely available. So the Guardian was only one paper of many carrying the documents. So, you know, there's all these games that media people play here. But clearly, what we're seeing is that facts are being buried in the coverage of all of this. And a lot of people really don't get what these things are. If WikiLeaks is shut down, if its leader and other people who work with them are, you know, prosecuted or killed, you know, this will be a terrible blow against freedom of information. You know, it's not clear these days that freedom of the press and freedom of information are the same things, because in many countries, especially ours, you know, the press is often the last place you turn to for real information. That's why we have the internet and so many internet sites, programs like yours. You know, this is independent media really challenging corporate media, challenging the dominant media, and offering other narratives. And that's why this is a fight, you know, for all of us who believe in freedom of information and the right to know. That's what's really at issue here, in my opinion.
That was Danny Schechter, award-winning independent filmmaker, author, and editor at MediaChannel.org. His most recent film and book are titled Plunder, The Crime of Our Time. Read Danny's News Dissector blog at MediaChannel.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446. Or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our newly redesigned website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.